Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Hear my words and bear witness to my vow. Night gathers and now my watch begins. It shall not end until my death. I shall take no wife, hold no lands, father no children. I shall wear no crowns and win no glory. I shall live and die at my post. I am the sword in the darkness. I am the watcher on the walls. I am the shield that guards the realm of men. I pledge my life and honor to the Night's Watch. For this night, and all the nights to come.
Hello and welcome to Still Watching Game of Thrones. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Vanity Fair chief critic Richard Lawson.
If you are just joining us, we are at the end of a, towards the end, I should say, of a 15-episode countdown of the top 15 most essential slash important episodes of Game of Thrones. This is our second to last episode where we are talking about Season 7, Episode 4, Spoils of War, written by Weiss and Benioff and directed by Matt Shakman. We have one more episode after this. That will be our most important, most vital, most essential Game of Thrones episode, which we will announce towards the end of this particular episode. But for right now, we've been doing this chronologically, so we've reached all the way to Season 7, and then our last episode will just be one we've plucked out of somewhere in the run as our most important. Richard, are you excited to talk about Spoils of War?
I am. I feel like on this podcast, I've been like a little bit like, oh, once they ran out of book material, the show kind of lost me, whatever. This is a really good episode. Like, it's just really well done, really well acted, really well written. And it takes moments to sort of consider the emotional weight of everything while also moving the plot forward. So hats off to them.
Yeah, absolutely. And this one, like, you know, Season 7 was a little hit or miss for me, and this idea of like balancing spectacle and substance, but this episode is like the quintessential marriage of like character and spectacle for me, so I'm really excited to talk about it. Before we get to our episode discussion, we wanted to do a few little things that we like to do here on Still Watching. First of all, we want to remind you that if you're not already a Vanity Fair subscriber, you can go to gameofthrones.com/thrones, enter the promo code thrones, get a whole year digital, print, tote bag, the whole thing for $7.50, which is insane. $7.50, whole year, Vanity Fair. You can go, you can read all our Vanity Fair stuff. You can read every review that Rich is going to file from Cannes. It's going to be a great time on VF.com, and you want to join us for that. Richard, why do you think people should jump on the $7.50 deal for Vanity Fair?
Because if they don't, we're going to burn their army down.
Great. We will hop on our dragons and roast you to bits and pieces if you don't. No, no threats. Just
I meant
incentives.
Metaphorically.
Oh, yes, yes.
Figuratively.
We'll scorch you with our words.
Speaking of subscribing to things, we should mention that you're going to be doing, there's going to be a Game of Thrones newsletter that people can subscribe to, right?
Yeah, you can, you know, so I write some stuff about Game of Thrones sometimes, and if you want, just a few things. I actually just did an interview, and the guy fact-checked how many, like, podcasts and articles that I've done about Game of Thrones, and he came up with 800, which made me, like, want to pass out a little bit. But
wow.
So anyway, I write a few things about Game of Thrones. If you want that delivered to your inbox via email during the season, there is something that we're doing called the Westeros Update. So if you go to www.westerosupdate.com, you can subscribe to this newsletter, basically, and get the latest Thrones content from VanityFair.com. So WesterosUpdate.com, you just type your email in and then bam, you're done. All right, so let us get into my challenge that I set for myself on these episodes is to recap the episode in 15 words or less. I have gotten a little lazier with trying to hit all the points as we've gone on, because hopefully this episode's a little bit fresher in people's memories. But anyway, I'm just calling this one Daenerys Targaryen invites House Lannister to a barbecue. That's this one. There's actually a lot of other stuff that happens in Spoils of War, but, you know.
And in some senses, doesn't House Lannister invite themselves to that barbecue?
They're always doing that. Mm-hmm. Forever self-inviting. And then we want to, you know, just hand out a few awards before we get to our episode discussion. Our first award is the obvious MVP of the episode. I'm going to give it to my boy, my constant problematic fave, Jaime Lannister. Who do you have, Richard?
Mine is, I think, also obvious. It's Drogon the Dragon.
I love it. And then we got to do sneaky MVP. I'm going to give it to the lovely Tom Hopper that people might know from Umbrella Academy or Black Sails. Shows up for like two episodes as recast as Sam's brother, Dickon Tarly. And he does a nice job making you care about him a little bit in this episode. So sneaky MVP, Tom Hopper is Dickon Tarly. Who do you have, Richard?
I think it's Davos Seaworth for finally kind of hinting at what we've all been knowing in terms of John having a crush on Dany. He finally kind of gets at it in this episode, and you're like, thank you.
Yes. Finally. All right. And then we want to read out our favorite quote from the episode. This is where we do really embarrassing accents and try to do impressions of the characters on the show. And I usually fail miserably. I don't have a quote from the battle itself. My quote comes from Winterfell, and it's, chaos is a ladder, which is Bran spooking Littlefinger by quoting his own words back to him. So chaos is a ladder. That's a callback to an earlier speech from the show. Richard, what is your quote?
Well, it's a little bit of dialogue. So it's Sir Jaime, Rickon, Dickon. And then Bran laughs at Dickon. Because who would?
Yeah, I feel like the joke is good because they do it in the earlier episode when you meet Dickon Tarly for the first time. He calls him something else as well. Probably also Rickon, but I think it was just like the show is trying really hard to get you to remember who Dickon Tarly is so that when they roast him, spoiler alert, in the next episode, you might care a little bit because they like just recast him. So it's a new actor and they have two episodes and they're like, okay, remember, his name is Dickon. Remember, we're going to need you to be upset next week when Daenerys kills them. Anyway.
And like George saddled us with this ridiculous name.
So here we go. All right. And then best dressed, I this is sort of like me biting off an earlier thing I said, which was I think earlier I voted for Tywin Lannister in his Lannister armor. I'm gonna give it to Jaime Lannister in his Lannister armor in this episode. He looks really good in that red armor. facing down the dragon. One of my favorite things that's ever happened. Richard, what is your vote? Best dressed.
I mean, there's a lot of good winter wear happening in Winterfell, you know, yes. But I got to say, and it's more of an accessory, but I love Bran and his like kind of pre-Victorian wheelchair. It's just a very like dashing look. So I'm going to go with that.
Yeah. Isaac Hempstead Wright told me in an earlier episode of this podcast, when we covered Home, that he has actually like this beautiful, really cool wizard's robe that Michelle Clapton made for him that he's wearing all the time, but he's just like sitting down and covered in furs all the time that you like can't tell. He's like, but when you stand up, it's really cool. And I was like, oh, what a shame. Like beautiful costume was never seen. All right. And then the last thing we're going to do is we're going to pick like a ship from the episode, two characters or inanimate objects or whatever that we wish would really get together. And I'm going to give it to our joint MVPs, Drogon and Jaime. I want them to just like hug it out, and maybe Jaime gets to ride that dragon. Like, why not? Who's your ship in this episode, Richard?
I know he doesn't deserve it, but when Theon gets off the boat and Jon like looks at him and Theon clearly expects him to like something really bad to happen, I was like, oh, maybe they're going to hug. I had forgotten, you know? Yeah. And I was like, oh, in that second, I wanted them to be like friends again.
Yeah.
If they ever really were friends. But then I was like, oh, right. But Theon did a lot of bad shit. So
he really did. Yeah. And I love that scene. And we'll talk about it a little bit, some of the battlefield stuff that happens in this episode. But that is a really good pick. This is an interesting episode because it, Matt Shackman is the director of this episode, but he felt like and when he was announced, everyone was like, what? Because he's like a comedy TV director. He's It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia director. But like the It's Always Sunny guys are like friends with Weiss and Benioff and some other people. And so like that relationship doesn't seem that confusing to me, but you're sort of like, what is Shackman doing here when like, you know, there are other names like Miguel Sapochnik decided to sit this season out. Like, but David Nutter actually told us in a previous episode of this podcast that he was supposed to, or at least at one point was in contention to direct this episode. He directed like The Red Wedding and Cersei's Walk and all this other stuff. But that he injured his back and so he couldn't do it. So Matt Shackman was sort of like a tap in, but he did an amazing job with this episode. It's so good. So
yeah, it's both emotionally resonant and the action stuff is, you know, pretty like awe-inspiring, and it all feels like this episode is super jam-packed with stuff and yet you don't feel like kind of overwhelmed by it.
Yeah. We have the Winterfell stuff, which as we mentioned, there's like this Bran and Littlefinger conversation, but there's like Arya Stark comes back to Winterfell in this episode. Arya Stark, who hasn't been home and since season one, comes back and she has some scenes with Sansa, some scenes with Bran. She gets a new weapon. And then she has this like really amazingly fun duel with Bran of Tarth, Gwendolyn Christie, one of my favorite things that happens in season 7. What do you think of this, all this Winterfell stuff?
I think it's great. I love it. I love the reunion stuff. I mean, that's just sort of, I'm sort of a sucker for that. But I think it's wonderful seeing these actors together again and realizing how much they've grown as actors since they were last together, you know? Like, I think Maisie Williams is really wonderful in the scene down in the crypt where she's, you know, just feels very sort of angry but forlorn and reconnecting with her sister, which is going to be a hard thing to do as later episodes in the season prove. And I also think that Sansa watching the duel or the kind of fake duel between Brienne and Arya is a beautiful, efficient way to communicate Sansa learning, oh my God, where has my sister been? What has she learned? Like, you know, it's just like a really neat way of kind of packaging that, you know, rather than have Arya kind of like lay it all out in exposition.
Yeah, absolutely. And like the stuff with Arya and Sansa becomes less enjoyable for me as the season goes on. Like I think some of the tension feels a little manufactured. So I really like this stuff. And then I like the very end of the finale when like they're working together and they talk, you know, the stuff in between is some of the stuff that I didn't love in season 7. So it's nice to revisit this episode, just like see them reunite, see Arya fight Brienne with this, like all this great integration of all the different fighting styles she's learned. See Littlefinger thrown for a loop in a way that you know, Sansa kind of catches him off guard here and there over the seasons, but like Bran really, really fucks with Littlefinger. And like it's so funny, it's an introduction of a new dynamic in the world where like strivers and schemers like Littlefinger can't survive in a realm where there's someone who knows everything that's ever happened with like Bran, you know what I mean? Like Littlefinger's superpowers are nothing compared to like, you know, when Bran can see it all, you know?
Right. And it's interesting, you know, like for as sort of connected and sort of devious and successful as Littlefinger is, he feels like one of those characters who, like, did he really ever actually believe the sort of magic stuff, you know? Was he using that superstition to his advantage? And then seeing Bran, he's like, oh, wait, like, this actually is real.
Yeah.
And I think that we see a lot of characters have those realizations over the years in the show. And I think it's always satisfying because we've known the whole time.
Yeah, that's true. And a big part of it is in this episode, Jaime seeing his first dragon. Right.
Yes, exactly.
You know, all right. So let's hop over to King's Landing, really quickly, which is just Cersei, you know, paying her debts as the Lannisters tend to do and talking about some mercenaries she's going to hire. So that's just fine. It's just Lyanna Headey, like, you know, scheming and drinking wine and doing whatever she likes to do or not.
It's always,
you know,
yeah. It's always been funny to me that Westeros does its banking overseas, like offshore, you know?
Yeah. It's the Cayman Islands. Braavos is the Cayman Islands of Game of Thrones.
Like, they're very intimately tied and sort of reliant on Braavos in this way that you think of Westeros being very, like, proud and self-sufficient. And, you know, so I just think it's, like, a funny detail.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, like, let's just cover Dragonstone before we go to the battle, which is Jon Snow has this very romantic little date in a cave. We get to hear a new piece of music from Ramin Djawadi, which I think is called Dragonglass, which is sort of the Jon and Daenerys love theme. We hear it kind of for the first time in this episode. And there was some really, I think I've mentioned this before that I'm notoriously bad at hearing, the music and the themes on this show, but, some people were much smarter than I am, like broke down the Dragonglass theme and noticed that there's like part of Jon and Ygritte's theme in it. And it's part of Khal Drogo and Dany's theme in it. And it sort of blends together to be like, these are, I find like oddly really touching. It's like we take our life experiences, our previous relationships, and we bring them to the table, you know, as we embark on this new relationship. Am I overthinking this? Or just...
No, I think that's kind of lovely. You know, I think it's lovely, even though I don't think that like Dany and Jon are like made for each other. You know what I mean?
It all feels, I mean, like, it can't help but feel rushed. You know what I mean? There are things that are seasons in the making, and then there's this, which just, you know, they've got 3 episodes or 4 episodes or whatever to make you believe that, no, like, this is episode 4, right? Or episode 5? Episode 4?
Yeah, 4.
You know, so they've got, like, 3 episodes, really, to make you be like, this is it. Endgame. Jon and Daenerys, you know, and then all of a sudden, like, Kit and Emilia are on the cover, you know, like, they're the ad campaign for season 8, you know, it's Kit and Emilia. And it's like, there's part of it is like, we've been with these characters for so long that, like, we're invested in their journey. And so you put you mash these two big, you know, heroic, burdened with destiny people together. And that's a big deal. But, like, there's just so little time. And so it just all feels, you know, whereas, like, Ygritte and Jon frolicked north of the wall for a while before, you know, she took him into that cave. So it's just a different timeline, a different pacing, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I do get the, you know, in sort of like, in terms of the text, like I get why these two young people who have been spending years with the weight of the world on their shoulders would meet each other and be like, oh my God, finally someone who gets it, you know, even though they're a bit wary of each other. So like that makes sense to me, but I don't think that the show is thematically heading toward a place where, Dany and Jon are like the great loves. I think it's their kind of coupling is almost more like strategic or something, you know what I mean? Like, I don't think they know that, but I think in terms of the storytelling.
Yeah, and I don't, I mean, like, certainly the fact that they're related might be something we want to consider. And I don't, I mean, and certainly what's also true is that this is not usually a story of happy ever afters. So it's not, you know, Jon and Daenerys get matching Iron Thrones and raise their tots in King's Landing or something like that. But, you know, in terms of them coming together, like, this is the Song of Ice and Fire that is, like, you know, she's, you know, he's ice, she's fire. And then, you know, we are not talking about any other season 7 episodes. This is our last one, that we're talking about in season 7. So we should just mention, you know, like, that they, you know, they consummate their flirtation in the final episode of the season. And what seems to me by all the hints that they drop in season 7 is that like Daenerys is definitely going to get pregnant with his baby. And so whatever that baby is,
with her nephew's baby.
Yeah. Welcome to Game of Thrones. So whatever, so her baby feels like maybe an important element of like, maybe the baby is the Song of Ice and Fire or something like that. But that, you know, there, I agree with you. I don't know if you're right that like the show doesn't want us to think that they are like a sort of romantic endgame, but I do think that they also serve this function of like, they come together. Like Melisandre even says this. Melisandre in season 7 says, you know, when she comes to Daenerys and she tells her about the Azor Ahai, you know, Messiah prophecy or whatever, and Missandei points out helpfully, like, oh, it's princess. It could be princess or prince that was promised. And Melisandre's like, you have a role to play, Daenerys, and Jon Snow has a role to play. That she says that. She just says that. And then later she says, I've done my job. I brought ice and fire together. And so I feel like this is all like make a baby language. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like you guys together maybe will create the Messiah that we need, possibly. I don't know.
Even though secretly the Messiah is Gilly's baby.
Absolutely. It's definitely little Sam. Okay. And then what else happens to the Dragonstone? Okay. And then like, you know.
Can we talk about the cave drawings?
Yes. Let's please talk about the cave drawings. Did you do them, Richard? Did you sneak onto Dragonstone and do
them? It kind of looked like I did them. You know what I mean? Yeah. They're not very good. But also, I think, you know, I've said it so many times on this podcast, but like, I love the history of this story and like when they look back into the ancient stuff. And I think it's just really intriguing. I just wish that the drawings had looked older, you know, production design wise. I wish they were a little more faded, a little less like literal or something. I don't know. But I do appreciate when the show pauses and considers its history.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to like knock production design too much, but it did like crack me up. The memes that came up around it were like, people were like, Jon Snow dusting like the chalk off his hands or whatever. Cause like, obviously it like helps him prove his case. And so they're like, it would have been, you know, fortuitous for him, to have done those cave drawings for his own end and sort of thing. So, anyway,
Right under her house.
Like, yeah, exactly.
How convenient.
He's like, da, 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 here they go. Yeah. And then we get all this stuff about Daenerys learning that Tyrion's, that Highgarden fell. One of my regrets about the fact that we only did 15 episodes of this rewatch, Richard, is that we didn't get to do the death of Olenna. So do you want to do your impression of Olenna Tyrell's last words, for us as Highgarden fell?
Tell Cersei. I wanted to know it was me.
Yeah, so good. So like Highgarden fell, that's a big thing that happened. And you know, Tyrion has to tell Daenerys that that happened, and she's like, okay, great, I'll just burn everything with my dragon. He's like, how about selective burning? Which results in Daenerys attacking Jaime Lannister on the road to King's Landing instead of torching King's Landing directly.
I like the moments when you see characters kind of look at Dany like, is she a little crazy? You know, I think it's an important part of her characterization that she too has this slight disease inside of her, which is this bloodthirsty, you know, want of power. And yes, we've been rooting for her since the beginning, and like she's better than a lot of other people. But like, I like when she's put in her in that context, you know. However, briefly.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I completely agree. And then we get this battle, and something that the writers, producers, etc., liked to tout was like that this was the first time we see a showdown between two characters that, you know, like the villains are gone, Ramsay's dead, Joffrey's dead, Tywin's gone, blah blah blah. The Night King's still lurking about, but like these are our heroes at sort of cross purposes with each other. And I mean, if you want to call Jaime Lannister that, which I do. That's not like entirely true. I think Brian Cogman brought up in our episode that we did about the children that like Brienne fighting the Hound counted. But this, something he said, which I thought was really interesting, is like, this is the first time we really see Dany clashing with people because like she's been divorced from the main plot for so long. So here's Daenerys. Right. Is coming at loggerheads with these Westerosi storylines that we've been watching for so long.
And it's like Jaime being like, it's like, you know, I've heard about the dragon Targaryen princess out, you know, east, whatever, and then actually seeing her and being like, oh my god, it's real. Like, she's like, it's a little bit like Littlefinger too, you know, like you said. And I just think those moments are so satisfying, because again, we've spent so many years with Dany, and to want to see, to realize like, oh, he's never seen her before.
I think
it's cool. And I think it's also just like, you know, the visceral little kid in me is like, dragons, oh my god. And it's been a while on the show since the dragons have kind of excited me. And I think that this, you know, sequence does it so well, like reminds us of the dragon's kind of majesty, while also, I think, showing us that, like, this is a really brutal form of warfare, you know? And I mean, it's all brutal, but, like, you know what I mean? Like, it's a bad way to go. And it's a bad thing to do to people. And she's doing it with glee, and we're kind of like cheering her on. And that all starts to feel a bit squicky. And I think that that is beautifully illustrated in Tyrion's reaction shots.
And then also my guy, Jaime, because like there's this moment where Nicolai Coster-Waldau as Jaime Lannister looks around the battlefield and looks around at all these people on fire, and then decides to make that like really foolish charge at the dragon, which is similar to, you know, like, and you have to think about all of Jamie's context, because we talked about this a lot when we did the Kiss by Fire episode, but like the whole idea of the fact that like Jaime Lannister saved King's Landing by killing the Mad King Aerys from using wildfire to burn King's Landing. And then here comes Aerys's daughter to burn a bunch of soldiers, not with wildfire, with dragon fire, but it's like similar. And he's like, this is what I ruined my entire reputation in order to prevent back at, you know, in Robert's Rebellion. And here it is again. And so here I am going to go again and make this foolhardy charge at something, in order. And it's like shot almost like a Vietnam War movie. You know what I mean? You just see these, like, it's like napalm. You just like see these people on fire. And, you know, in later in this podcast episode, we're talking to Sam Conway, who does the special effects. And I believe they broke the world's record for like number of stuntmen they set on fire at once. They set 30 people on fire. Yeah. So like, you know, they did so much. They do so much like practically, and that's something, you know, like the CGI of the dragon looks so good, but there's also just like they do so much work with like actual fire, and you can tell, and it just makes it feel, it doesn't feel like a cartoon, oh, a dragon has just torched a bunch of people. It feels so visceral and real in this battle.
I also love, I don't even know how to describe it, but in the score, whenever the dragons do something that like descending kind of sound. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Spoiler. I mean, we could just say, can we say what our final episode is? Should we just say?
No, we should wait. Let's wait.
Okay. I'll have more on that in that episode. But anyway, yes, that it's a great little like, like descending. Yeah,
it's a little Hans Zimmery, but like, yeah, so you know, good. In a fun way.
Yeah, I really like it. And then also one of my favorite shots of all of Game of Thrones is in this episode, which is the Dothraki screamers, the riding in, and they got these like horse stunt guys to like actually like stand up on their horses, doing what my friend called horse parkour. And it's just like, it's just, once again, it's this practical effect, you know, it's actually in camera. You've got these stunt guys on these, you know, these riding stunt guys on horses, and they just look incredible. And you could have CG'd that, but it would have looked like garbage, and it just looks so good. And at this point, you know, I knock Game of Thrones all the time for the fact that like there's so much more spectacle, more battle, whatever, as the series goes on. But like the fact that they have more, you know, and when they promoted the season, they're like epic, biggest dragon ever, blah blah blah. But when they put the money down to do so much of it practically and to make it look as good as it does, then you just get to forget that you're watching a story about dragons and just like get swept away and like what's Bronn doing? What's Jaime doing? What is Tyrion watching, sort of thing, you know?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I'm with you in terms of being a little bit leery of like the maximalized Game of Thrones where everything has to be an epic battle scene or whatever. But like when it's done well, you know, and it's a little bit different than what you've seen before, it's pretty exciting, you know. So hats off to a comedy director for nailing it.
Yeah, and I mean, I think not to like deprive Matt Shackman of his credit, but I think at this point on Thrones, it's like such a like a unit. Do you know what I mean? Like they're DPs, they're special effects people, they're production design people, they're stunt people, you know, that they like, it's a machine and you step into it. I don't think a single director on Game of Thrones could fuck it up at this point is my point, because it's like the machinery is too intense. But I think, you know, as we discussed with like The Door, you know, with Jack Bender in The Door, I think there are directors who can bring just like something more to it. Something Miguel Sapochnik certainly does. And whatever it is that Max Shackman did on this, I only have one episode of Game of Thrones to understand what his directing style for Game of Thrones is, but it's like, it's a good one. So what, you know, I'm not going to knock
it.
I think
I could have fucked it up I'm not, I guess, technically a director, but you know what I mean? Like, yeah, but you're right. I mean, I should give credit to this crew that does all this amazing stuff and is used to it, and that has made it so, like, yeah, the directors, while not interchangeable exactly, certainly are only one part of a very big, beautiful machine.
And that's, I mean, that's sort of, I, you know, not to get too sentimental or self-aggrandizing or anything like that, but that's kind of been the point of this podcast, is to revisit mm-hmm. like a bunch of the people who have gone slightly unheralded here and there, who have been so instrumental in making this. I love, like, everything that Paula Farrah-Field, who does the like sounds on the dragons, said on the last episode, is so interesting when you watch this episode and you think of the fact that she like considers these dragons like her children, because she's been like making the noises for them since they were like babies, you know, toddlers. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, something she said that I loved is there's like, it's not just like the dragon roar, it's the sound of the dragon bodies as they move, like all the sound as well as the visuals make you buy into the fact that this is a dragon is an actual thing with weight and power, and if you can buy into that, then you can buy into the story that they're trying to tell you. And but that's instrumental, like, because if you have a shitty CG thing, and there's a million examples that we could give you of that in film, in television, then I'm just like, I'm just distracted watching that shitty CG. So this is like, you know, this is more like Jurassic Park, where like I believe those dinosaurs are real, and I believe at least in this iteration, maybe not some of the like early baby dragon stuff, but in these iterations, I believe those dragons are real and have weight and have power, and it's huge.
I agree.
All right, is there anything else you want to say about this episode? If I wax poetic enough about it,
You know, goodbye, Dickon. We hardly knew you. I mean, he has one more episode, I know, but.
Yeah, the only thing I didn't like actually about this episode is I really don't like the way it ends, because it ends with like this, I think, pretty stupid cliffhanger of like Jaime and Bronn sinking into the water there, and we find out that they're fine the next episode, and I just feel like it was like a little bit of a cheap, because okay, so you have this battle between two people we care about. And, you know, something that I've heard the showrunner say is like, you know, and someone you care about is going to die. But actually what's true is that nobody we care about actually dies in this battle, right? Like, mm-hmm. Daenerys is fine. Drogon's fine. Bronn's fine. Jaime's fine. Tyrion's fine. The Tarleys we don't actually really care about. So like, you know, the fact that they die next week is fine. But it ends with this like implication that maybe Bronn and Jaime are not going to make it. I don't mind Bronn saving Jaime. I don't mind them like last minute missing the Dragonfire. I don't mind them like landing in the river and it washing them downstream and them escaping. I just mind that it ended with this sort of will they survive kind of thing. And that it felt like, yeah, just like a little bit of a cheap shot in terms of storytelling that this episode didn't need, because it was so good, you know?
Yeah, totally. And it's like abrupt also, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, Oh, we just ran out of time. Goodbye, you know? But other than that, I think it's a really strong episode. Perhaps one of the best of the season. Yeah, I mean, really, that's why we picked it, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like, people might quibble with the fact that we didn't pick the finale, and that's fine. There's just, like, a lot of stuff that happens in the back half of the season that feels to me like the show on fast forward. And mm-hmm. this is... I think the last point of the season where I am like fully on board with it. But yeah, I mean, like, to be perfectly honest with you, if you are genuinely doing this 15 episode rewatch with us, you might want to go ahead and rewatch Dragon and the Wolf, which is the season 7 finale. Like, you know, why not? I mean, it's going to be your previously on. You're going to want to, like, just, oh, yeah, Littlefinger died. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I did. I rewatched it after watching this one because I was like, yeah, I might as well.
Yeah, so, you know, fair enough. We're not going to talk about it, but, you know, you should probably watch it. Fair enough, you know. All right, well, that is it for our discussion of Spoils of War. We are now going to go to our interview with special effects supervisor Sam Conway.
The Run Through with Vogue is where you'll meet all the most exciting people in fashion and culture.
I am Fran Lebowitz, who should be the mayor of New York.
We all support that. We support that.
Very nice.
Nikki.
Yes.
It's been really great being in this beautiful pink room.
All right, Usher, can you hear us?
I can hear you.
All right.
Can you hear me?
We can.
We can.
All right, here we are.
On the podcast, you'll learn how Vogue really works.
Sometimes we'll come in for a second or even third run through until we are AWOK.
Can you tell us what AWOK means?
It means AWOK, Anna Wintour OK.
I'm Cho Minardi.
And I'm Chloe Mel.
And we're the hosts of The Run Through with Vogue, where fashion and culture collide.
Join us. It's AWOK.
Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
This message comes from Apple Card. Earn up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase every day. Then grow it at 4.50% annual percentage yield when you open a savings account with Apple Card. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card subject to credit approval. Savings available to Apple Card owners subject to eligibility. Savings accounts provided by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, member FDIC. Terms apply.
Okay, so we're talking about Spoils of War, which is the episode where the Game of Thrones production team broke the Guinness Book of World Records for most stuntmen burned at the same time, which is 20. So it is only fitting that we are speaking with special effects supervisor Sam Conway. Sam Conway, for those who don't know, what exactly does a special effects supervisor do?
We mostly create effects, physical effects, in camera. In other words, in reality. And we also add to the VFX element shoots and plate shots. You know, we give them things that they need and they put them into their work. But specifically, you know, we're involved with a sort of like, you know, mostly destruction. We'll build gates that we can destroy, you know, explode or break. We'll be doing a lot of fire stuff too. We're involved with the stunts, the stunt burns. We do a lot of hydraulic work, pneumatics, animatronics. What else do we do? We'll call it atmospherics as well, you know, and for the phones stuff, we were doing a lot of the snow as well, all the snow. So fell a bit, I think.
I was talking to Deb Riley, and she said the fake snow is one of her least favorite aspects of Game of Thrones because it just sort of gets everywhere. Is it possible to deal with?
It's one of those things that you can finish a job 6 months ago and you still be fine in the snow. Yes, it's just everywhere. It's always there.
My understanding is that you get the scripts and then you sit down with sort of the more digital effects side of things and you guys go through the script and say, okay, we can do this practically. We're going to have to do this digitally. Is that accurate?
So basically what we tend to do is we sit down with sort of, you know, in a pre-production sort of mode alongside, say I'd have meetings with VFX and then we work out, you know, where the parameters are, what I can do physically, and what they can provide VFX wise. And then, you know, basically sort of becomes a bit of a symbiotic kind of, you know, department, really. Department of two halves. That's kind of how it works.
Has there ever been a conversation where, you know, digital effects says, obviously we have to do this. And you're like, no, we can do this practically. And this is how I'm going to do it. Anything that you sort of fought for on that front?
Yeah, plenty. But I mean, what the reason is that Joe Barra really would prefer to do anything physically. And, you know, and that's great. But obviously, I can't build dragons and stuff like that. So there's obviously limitations that I just cannot do. And what I do is tend to give him what he needs to make it convincing. Mm-hmm. Hence the fire, all the fire breathing, you know, all that's real. You know, it's all every time you see fire in front, it's all real. We've provided it. So
that's always one of the fun behind the scenes, videos that you see is these contraptions you've built that just shoot fire. You know, it's just these like riggings that shoot fire around the set and stuff like that.
That's it. We become almost complacent with all that. We just bring it out, upset it up, bang it off, and then put it away again.
It's just dragon fire. It's fine.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's just shoots a flame 120 foot, but, you know, don't worry about that.
When you do something like, like season 6, the wildfire, that's all digital, right? Wildfire is digital?
Yeah, so wildfire, because my predecessor, Stuart Luton, he was asked if he could do, I think it was season 3, when there was the attack in the harbour, Black Harbour.
Season 2.
Was it season 2? Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, well done, thank you. Anyway, so we were asked to do Green Fire, and it's very hard to do, and it's very, especially that scale. So it became obvious that VFX, we give them the fire and then they colourise it. Like, for example, the one you've just said, with the start of that whole explosion was in the basement in the cellar. And so what I did was to build a half-scale set and then stand it upright and then did a couple of fuel explosions. And the camera's mounted at the end and it comes rushing towards the camera as if it's like, you know, actually happening in the vault itself. So then VFX took those flames, took that effect, and put it into its environment with a green colour.
Oh, that's amazing. So, like, that shot, I think the shot you're just describing is, like, the one where you can see, like, the barrels on either side of sort of the hallway, and it's, like, coming right at you. And that's actual fire been treated. Oh, very cool.
That's actual fire. That's a half-scale set.
Oh, very cool. Interesting. And then, so you came on in season 4, is that right?
Yeah, I started in season 4 for Wolf Unit. I was running the floor Wolf Unit. There's two units, there's Dragon Unit and Wolf Unit, and it's like basically first unit or main unit and second unit, you know, it's that sort of thing, really.
Right, and then is Wolf the one in Belfast, or is Wolf the one sort of abroad?
Strangely enough, the Wolf Unit was the one that was mostly going abroad.
Okay.
The Dragon Unit would stay in Belfast,
mm-hmm.
and Wolf Unit would go off to do the sort of like, you know, the Morocco, the Croatia.
Right.
And the Spain thing, so.
So what was the first thing you did on season 4 that made you really feel like, wow, I've stepped into this really cool new job?
I was gobsmacked with the scale of what they had. You know, I mean, like the big snow sets and the going away and risking taking a whole unit over into another country and taking over locations for a TV show. I thought that was quite stunning. You know, I'm quite ambitious and, you know, pretty awesome.
Yeah, absolutely.
Those early days, there wasn't really a great deal of effects work. I mean, it was, but it wasn't like, you know, it was like making sets look cool. But no kind of like, you know, the dragons were too small and there wasn't too many serious battles going on, so.
Right. You had like a little bit of dragon, like a puff of fire, and that's about it. You know?
Yeah, that's it. I mean, I think it got a bit more exciting in season 5 when we did the Daznak.
Right, the fighting pit where Drogon swoops in to save Daenerys from the Heartbee attack.
So then we were out there doing that, and that's when it started ramping up a bit. I think that was Hardhome season, actually. I think Dragon were doing Hardhome, and we were out there doing that.
Do you wish that you had gotten to be on the Hardhome shoot at all?
You're kidding me, right?
All that snow.
Yeah, all that luck, yeah. I could be in Spain. Send fire to something.
Okay, and I know that you know, there was much discussion in season 7 about all the stuntmen you set on fire for Spoils of War, that it was like a record breaking conflagration sort of thing. Can you talk about some of the discussions around that, when you decided you were going to do that, when someone told you that's crazy, don't do that, and you were like, nope, we're going to do it, let's do it?
Yeah, so it all came about when, you know, the early sort of pre-production production meetings, rather, not pre-production, discussing how we do we break down the previs. There's a previs that gets made, and we all sit around breaking it down, working out, you know, if you've got a shot where there's, say, 20 men and they all get hit by dragon fire, then do we do that in bits? Do we make it so it's like 4 men at a time or something like that? But Rowley was keen, because obviously it's a record, Rowley was keen to do all 20 in one hit. You know, and I wasn't shying away from that. The only sort of thing, my concern was 20 people is a lot, and there's a lot of heat generated. So I was concerned about the people in the middle, basically, the stunt guys in the middle. But we developed a nice system of igniting stuntmen, and also the strafe as well. We also worked out a really good system for the strafe work. And because we coincided the two, we put strafe and we put the igniters amongst the stuntmen. We also came out of a really nice stunt flame gel, which would light instantly. You know, I mean, most stunt gels are normally, they take a little while, a little bit too long to light up. So we came up with a real nice system. But we came up with that system for Dasnik, that method. So from Dasnik onwards, we've been using that all the time.
What is stunt gel made of? What is that?
Well, that'd be a secret, wouldn't it?
Okay.
It's pretty special recipe. It's something flammable, but something that doesn't, you know, make itself obvious. You know, because some of the gels are a colour. They're normally they're normally clear and they're burnt to white, or they're normally like a glue, and you can see the glue, you know, like a contact adhesive. So this stuff, you can't. And as I say, it lights instantly, so, which is perfect for all these stunt gags that needed something like that.
You've mentioned the Dasnik Drogon drops down and barbecues a bunch of Sons of the Harpy and stuff like that. But there's this other big Daenerys fire scene in season 4 when she's like negotiating over the dragons, and then you just see that she burns a slave master, and then there's that iconic like fire going everywhere. How did you pull that one off?
So basically that was all fire trays with a pyrotechnic igniter. Sometimes, you know, wind can kick up, you weren't expecting, and then the flames come towards the lovely hair-sprayed hair.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Has the hairspray ever caught on set of Game of Thrones?
No, it was when I remember once when I was a child, it's just a little story. When I was a child, we were out for lunch in London with my parents, and this woman had gone to the toilet, and she'd obviously given her hair a bit of a spruce up. Because when she came back, when she lit a cigarette, not only did her hair go up, but her jumper gap went up as well.
Oh, my God. So that's forever in your head when you're
forever in my head.
Effects.
Just a simple cigarette lighter. That was enough. So.
Can you recall anything that you did in the early seasons that you thought was really, you know, big or daunting at the time, and now you look back and you're like, oh, man, I didn't even know how big it was going to get?
Yeah. My background is more complex than you know, than the phones TV experience at the start. So I, you know, I had it all in my arsenal anyway, my mental arsenal. Going, you know, thinking about the sort of ambitious stuff at the early days, I mean, there was lots of stuff out in Croatia that we're doing, like, I suppose, the Shame Walk. That was quite big and ambitious.
Yeah.
You know, we had gags to do in that, which were, you know, they had to be, they had to happen at certain times, because that's the kind of, the whole process was a handheld camera following her all the way through. And she went through lots of different areas, and every area there was something going on. So that was quite daunting, sort of thinking about that.
So what was your, what exactly is your job in like the walk, in Cersei's walk? What is your team working on?
Well, we had well, you have this sort of general atmosphere that's going on anyway. So you've got lots of stalls that have got lots of things going on, like smoke and bits and pieces, and then there's dust in the air, and there's people gobbing, you know, at her, spitting. Spitting at her. There's people throwing feces and stuff, which is, you know, all this sort of thing. We manufacture the spit and the feces, and sometimes, in some cases, throw it. You know, that sort of thing. It's just, it was difficult to kind of make sure that we all went through the right bits and pieces. So
I forgot that you do the snot. I had forgotten that that's in your department.
Yeah, it's one of those ones. It's either falls into makeup, or it falls in props if it's on something already, or, you know. But generally speaking, you know, we did a kind of a flying snot sort of stuff that happens. If it travels through the air, we tend to do it.
And then you do the, not to get too gruesome, but you do the blood as well, right?
Yes, we do. Lots of blood. Basically, as I said, this goes back to Joe and him wanting to do everything as real as possible, Joe Barra. And so we all always put some kind of blood rig where there's supposed to be a sword, even though the sword doesn't exist. You know, they had the sword afterwards, and we'll be doing a big old gruesome blood spurt from the area it's supposed to go into. Will come out of. So yeah, we normally have to rig little blood gags on the actors or the stunts, and then it's all a question of getting it right and getting it in the camera, you know, because half the time they're full of adrenaline and they're flying around everywhere. If they hit the button at the wrong time, we don't see it, but you always know. We always know it's gone off because everything's covered in blood. So it's just, the camera.
Do you have I don't know if this is a disgusting question, but do you have a favorite, like, blood spatter, blood spurt?
I do actually. Yeah, I think the whole mountain thing was great when we did the mountain practice in Dubrovnik, and he was chopping up the guys he was practicing against. There was lots of blood gags in that. And then when we did the Viper as well, the mountain and the Viper, we practiced those eye squeezes. We have loads of footage of those eye squeezes. And then you know, there was just lots of moments, fond memories of that one. Yeah.
Fond memories. Are you saying eye squeezes? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, eye squeezes. Yeah, you know, haven't you heard of that before?
Yeah, I know.
Say it all the time, haven't we? I think that was a moment where everyone screamed when they watched it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That's probably the blood spatter of Game of Thrones is the Viper's head popping open like that.
Yeah. I do remember that there was a quick one when we were doing it, and I had to do it to the script, a blood spurt, and one of the blood spurts, and I set it all up, did a test, and when we did it on the shoot, the first assistant insisted he stood behind me, and he was wearing a white shirt and a lovely Panama hat, and I said, "You better not stand there, you're going to get covered," and he said, "No way I'm going to get covered." So we filmed it, and I hit my cue, and he didn't shout cut. He shouted something else. I turned around, and he was absolutely covered. But yeah, that's a good memory.
And then because you were working in the sunnier locations at season 5, you didn't do the Jon Snow's stabbing, right? That's the... The dragon unit did that.
Yep, start on season 6. We had to carry that on because he was in his pile at the start of season 6, and they took him off to his room in his dead state. So yeah, but the actual stabbing itself was quite complex insofar as knowing exactly where these stabs were going to happen. And the lads had to kind of make pipe work through the costume and all that sort of thing, and make sure that the blood was pumping out the same places that the guys were stabbing, which is really tricky because, you know, it's so easy to sort of point at a picture and say, well, there's a hole. But when they're actually in the action, it changes everything. So, but when he lies down, there was copious amounts of pipes going into him, and he's lying in his spot. And the lads built a fiberglass mound in the shape of a snow pile that he could lie in. So therefore we had a constant flow of blood because the snow just stops the blood instantly. You know, it comes out and it just disappears.
Oh,
you can't
see
it. So you can waste gallons and gallons and gallons of blood and not see anything. So rather than do that, the lads built this fiberglass sort of shape, and then the blood obviously can't sink in. It just has to go. So it runs out.
Yeah. And I don't know if you pay attention to silly fan theory nonsense, but I remember when that happened, there was all this, people were so sure that you could see like a dragon and a wolf in the blood ooze there. Is that people being just mental and look and seeing something that wasn't there?
I don't, you know, there's a small recollection of, because also I think someone said that about when they broke for the Eastwatch wall, and they reckon that the army of the dead was shaped like the wolf head. But I don't know if that was intended for the blood, actually. I don't know. I don't think it was. I don't, sometimes, unless of course they did it in post. They might have done it in post, but the blood that came out kind of just did what it had to do. Kind of ran out, right. And ran across the fiberglass, you know?
Just did its job. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
There's also, I'm sorry if this is gross that I'm just like on a blood spree now, but.
You're not going to gross me out.
I was just thinking about the poison that the women in Dorne use, where you get this bleed, this trickle that comes out of your nose.
Yeah.
How do you do that sort of that trickle like that?
Well, there's a million ways to do it, but the easiest way was that makeup literally just squirted some blood up the nose, and it just sort of comes out on its own gravity.
So that's more makeup than
more makeup. Than yeah, normally, yeah, normally
sticking a pipe up an actor's nose.
Sticking a pipe up to an actor's nose would be more arse in some respects. Like we did a 28 days later, and one of the actors, we had to make a vomit rig, so it was a pipe at the side of the mouth, and it just spewed out just blood and viscous.
So, lovely. I was going to ask you, what did you work on before that you feel like most prepared you to work on Game of Thrones?
I did Troy, I did loads of things. I think 28 Days Later was good because it was improvised. A lot of it was improvised. We all knew what was roughly going on, but we did a lot of stuff from the back of the truck. No, Danny would have a meeting in the morning, like a breakfast on the bus, and then we'd discuss how we do the day. And then Danny would go, "I'd really like to see something like this," and we'd come up with what games we could. We had in the back of the truck. He'd give us, say, "How long would it take for do this?" And I'd say, "A couple of hours." And say, "Well, okay, we won't use you for a couple of hours at the start of the day. Go and make something, and come back and show him." And be like, "Rick, let's get cameras on it."
That's such a good looking movie too. That's a great, such a great movie.
Yeah, he's a fantastic director. Great man. Inspirational.
I know, like, I've talked to a bunch of people about this, so I'm gonna ask you this question. I know you can't like say much at all, but is there anything that you're excited for people to see in season 8 that you worked on? If there's anything like vaguely you can say about that.
I think I can probably say expect much, much bigger. Expect horror. Expect all sorts of violence. All sorts of, it's the end game, isn't it? So, stuff has to be destroyed. That's about as far as I can go. I don't think I can go much more than that.
Is it fair to say that your blood guys were busy in season 8?
You know, we were. Or every part of us were busy.
I'm sure.
So that kind of says everything. Everything was brought to the table and multiplied by 5,000. That wasn't, a lot of that was pretty much every department, So I think records were broken in season 7, and I think everyone tried to break as many records as they possibly could in the last one. So yeah, expect big.
Was there, and this I don't think is spoilery, it's just sort of more emotion, like how did you feel when you did the last thing you were ever going to do for Game of Thrones?
Tired. I've been on it for a year and a couple of months, and when we started filming, we'd never had a respite, and then the last thing we did when it was called cut, that was the last of frame. of a film they were to go for a camera for Game of Thrones, and it was like emotion obviously, and but tired, elation, and what I wanted was a beer. And a holiday.
Well, you probably earned it. So, yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much for chatting with me. I really, really appreciate it. This
that's
was
okay.
really great.
That's fine. Okay. I hope I'm bored you too much.
No. And I don't think any eye squeezes is like a photo will take with me forever. So, thank you for that.
Yeah. You're welcome.
All right, so that is it for Spoils of War. Now is the time, drum roll, to announce our final episode. Richard, what are we going to talk about next time on Still Watching?
We are going to talk about the granddaddy of them all, Season 6, Episode 10, The Winds of Winter.
The Winds of Winter are upon us, yes.
It's boom boom. Everything goes boom boom.
Yeah, Everything Go Boom Boom is the technical name of the episode. We will be talking about the Sept Explosion, stuff like that. We will explain to you why we think that, like, this is the episode, but it is the one that Richard and I unanimously agreed upon was, like, the episode. So we will talk about that next time. We also have a great interview with composer Ramin Djawadi on that episode. So we will see you. That will drop on Sunday, premiere time. So... you can listen to it Sunday morning, get all amped up for the season 8 premiere of Game of Thrones. This episode itself was edited and produced by Dave Gonzalez. Richard, until we're back for Boom Boom Time, where can people find you?
In a cave doing an elaborate series of like faked ancient drawings trying to convince Richard Madden to love me. But I'll also be on Twitter at rylawsandvf.com. Where will you be?
I'll be with Bran just waiting to hear him drop more truth bombs on people about weird things he knows about their lives in Winterfell, because that seems like a really fun game to me. Bran,
oh,
go
totally.
Ahead. Do that it's, thing.
It's like in movies like Edge of Tomorrow where someone repeats the day, and it's just so fun watching them like spook people because they're like, he's going to sit there, you know, whatever. It's
oh, yeah. otherwise, you can find me on VF.com or you can follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. Also, Richard and I talked about Game of Thrones on our other podcast, Little Gold Men, this week. So if you want to check that out, as if you haven't heard us talk enough about Game of Thrones, we do some more over there. We will see you next time.
We've all been there before. You're planning a dinner party or having family over or even just cooking for yourself when all of a sudden it starts to feel overwhelming.
I live in a very small one-bedroom apartment with a very small kitchen.
I can't figure out what to serve besides water soup at this point.
I'm Chris Morocco, food director of Bon Appetit and Epicurious, and this is Dinner SOS, a new podcast from Bon Appetit. Maybe it's a last-minute party with no menu inspiration, a kitchen with no space, a toddler who will only eat buttered pasta. Name your dinner emergency. We're here to help. Here's how the show works. On each episode, we'll take a call from a home cook facing a real dinner emergency. Then I'll work with one of our editors or someone from our amazing test kitchen to try and solve it. Because cooking for the people you love should inspire joy without a side of stress. Make sure you're following Dinner SOS wherever you're listening now.